Thanks very much. Of course, the challenge today is going to be keeping myself awake, not keeping the audience awake. But perhaps following John's presentation earlier, the term cloud computing might be more appropriate. I have to be honest and largely agree with a lot of what John said. We're not going to find that cloud computing solves the crap software problem that we face, and a problem which, if we're honest about it, is actually quite acute in the broadcast industry. We're quite guilty of writing software which isn't always to the best standards, mainly because we're serving a niche market, and there really isn't the economy there to develop software in the same way that some of the bigger organisations do, and still manage to muck it up, as John so eloquently pointed out. So I'm not going to sort of pretend that cloud computing is going to sort out this issue of software problems, but hopefully I can demonstrate how it might make life a little bit easier for running that crap software that we've all had to deal with. This session, as we sort of move towards lunchtime, is really about getting practical with the technology. So really appreciated Chris's presentation this morning, laying out the broad strokes. I'm going to cover a little bit of the ground that he covered because you can't really talk about cloud computing without going back over the history of virtualization, which is basically the history of IBM, if we're honest about it. So I will just touch on a few things that he's done, but hopefully bringing it towards a kind of a focus on the broadcast side of things. As with any kind of major shift in technology, there's always the bandwagon, the cloud computing bandwagon. And I'm sure it won't be long before we find someone selling a studio in the cloud or something at IBC next year, or some other crazy thing. What we really want to do is look at some of the kind of underlying technologies and try and work out what is it actually going to be good for? You know, it's not going to be the panacea. It's not going to fit every scenario, but it is going to be good for certain things. So in order to do that, we will have to take a look at virtualization. It does kind of underpin most of the technology that we'll look at. As I said, we'll take a look at how it works for broadcasters. We'll look a little bit at the history and how that fits in, how we can actually then move to the cloud, because it's no use just thinking that we're going to create new greenfield applications. Obviously, there's a whole legacy of 10 or 20 years worth of the way we've always done things in broadcast, and we can't just ignore that. We have to work with it and make sure that we can fit in with the legacy. We'll look at some of the kind of recent history and the things that have enabled the cloud. Cloud's relatively new. We're only going back, say, 4 years since the term started to be sort of bandied about. So it's a relatively, although the technology's quite old, it's a relatively young concept. We'll have a look at some current applications in broadcast, and it's quite fitting that following this we're going to have a demonstration from Forbidden, who are actually going to demonstrate some of this things working. Over the summer this year, I created a sort of proof of concept of some of the things that I'm talking about this morning based on a cloud platform. So most of this is grounded in reality, and that's my aim, is to bring these kind of clouds down to earth, as it were. We're going to look at redundancy and DR, because I think that's an area where this could really have some major applications, both in terms of reducing the cost of deploying those kind of services, and we all know just how expensive it can be to run a DR site if you're going to create it in the traditional sense. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And we'll also cover how systems integration — I work for a systems integrator, so I couldn't get away without talking about how we actually integrate these systems together. So like any broadcast system, a cloud system is going to be made up of a multitude of different suppliers. So you will have people coming with a single vendor solution, like IBM, like HP, but there will also be a place for the best of breed solution, where we take bits from legacy equipment, we take bits from cloud providers, and we piece those together. The final thing I want to do is is just have a look at future developments. There's a lot of equipment manufacturers in the room, so I want to do a bit of gap analysis and sort of give you a heads up on, okay, if this is what's going to happen in the next 3 or 4 years, these are the gaps and this is what needs to be filled. So, yeah, and then we'll do some conclusions and questions at the end. So what exactly is virtualization? There's a thing, a concept called the von Neumann design, which is basically a sort of model of a computer. And the architecture, which von Neumann sort of dreamed up, was this idea of a central processing unit with random access memory or just some form of persistent storage, and then input and output. That's how you defined the computer, and we tend to think of it as a sort of physical host. So it might be a laptop, it might be a server in a rack, but basically it's a box that's got those four peripherals in. And traditionally, we would then put a host operating system on the top of that. So that could be Windows, it could be Linux, it could be some proprietary system that's going to basically manage the way that the data is handled within those resources. And then on top of that, we install our applications. So we might have multiple applications if it's a desktop computer. So we might have Microsoft Word, Microsoft Excel. Let's try and think of one that isn't Microsoft. Adobe Photoshop. So, you know, we've got a whole pile of different applications there. And generally, we'll use one application, close it down, open another one. And we've all had those problems with incompatibilities between them. And then in the corporate environment, we might run a single application on a single machine. So a web server would run that single machine. So when we virtualize something, we basically put in a virtual machine manager, or sometimes a hypervisor, which effectively sits and distributes the underlying technology. So we've got a CPU there, and we've got some memory, and we can start to partition that up. So it might be by time, and different ones work in different ways. I'm not going to go into all the details of how the different hypervisor works, but basically they can time slice the CPU, they can partition the memory, and basically provision out virtual machines that clone and copy that underlying hardware. Now, sometimes they copy it exactly. Other times they copy a sort of like a sort of projection of alternate technology. So it might put a different BIOS in there, the basic input output system. It might pretend to be an Athlon chip or a Intel chip or a particular kind of chip. But basically those virtual machines can then be run up, and you're not limited to just having one of those. You can have as many as your CPU can handle. The major advantage of doing this is that you can then install your applications on top of those virtual machines, but they're completely isolated from each other. So the virtual machine manager, if it's doing its job properly, makes sure that the memory is kept completely separate. So the scenario we had before, where we perhaps would like to install a web server and, for example, a database application on the same processor, because, you know, maybe we've looked at it and they only really use maybe 5% of the CPU on one of them and 10% on the other. So, you know, we've got this 100% CPU power here. We might as well put them both on the same application. But when we actually come to do it, we find we haven't got the right DLLs in the right places. We haven't got the right service pack. Windows has decided that it's going to go off and auto-update itself today. And, you know, our database application's on its knees, but the other application suddenly solved a load of the problems that we had over the weekend. So you've got this real issue with that traditional approach, and using virtualization helps to get us around that. How many of you here use a Macintosh computer? How many of you use VMware Fusion or Parallels? Okay, so quite a few of you in the room are already using a virtual machine there. That runs Parallels and VMware Fusion, effectively provide this virtual machine manager that sits on top of the Mac operating system. When we move more into the enterprise market, we find that the virtual machine manager doesn't sit on top of the operating system, which is actually quite inefficient. The virtual machine manager actually gets installed on what we tend to refer as the bare metal. So basically we take the computer out, it's got nothing on it, and we just install the virtual machine manager. And it basically acts like an operating system. And we get incredibly good, efficient results with this. So it's important to recognize that this isn't emulation, this is virtualization. So the x86 instructions, the kind of chip instructions, are identical. So they're just being tunneled to the chip. They're not being translated. So I think some of us in the past have used sort of PC and Mac emulators with, you know, fairly disastrous results, because those two instruction sets prior to Apple moving to an Intel platform were quite different. So it's important to recognize the differences. And that virtual machine manager, when it sits on top of that, from my own testing, you can get somewhere between 4% and 5% efficiency, reduction in efficiency of the engine. So if you're looking to put two applications onto a single server that both consume 10% of the CPU's resources, you can ramp it up to 20%, and then you just add an extra 4% overhead, roughly, for the actual virtual machine manager's work. So it's actually a relatively efficient process. One of the big advantages, which Chris sort of touched on, is if you've got a range of physical hosts, when you're using these enterprise virtual machine managers, you can actually run that across a range of hardware. So if you've got a data center that's full of hardware, you can run this piece of software across the whole lot. So you basically install it on them separately, and then it provides a kind of interlinked solution. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, the big advantage of that is you can then run up, say, a bunch of virtual machines running on those applications and a bunch of maybe mission-critical applications that are sitting on top of them. But what happens if, you know, at the end of the day, whenever we're talking about clouds and things, ultimately, at the base layer, at the infrastructure layer, there's a physical machine somewhere that's doing the work, okay? You know, we can call it cloud and we can call it virtualization, try and pretend to ourselves that, you know, it's just out there somewhere. But actually, there's a physical machine at the bottom that's actually doing some work. And that physical machine can die, just like, any physical piece of hardware can die. Yeah, sure, it's got dual power supplies and all the rest of it, but it's not going to stop the cleaning lady coming in and pulling both plugs out at the same time. So let's say that machine, that physical host, dies. What happens to the applications on it? They die as well, okay? Now, because we've got a virtual machine manager that's sitting across all of those machines, and we've got shared storage, which is where those virtual images are being provisioned from, we can actually physically move those hosts across to another physical host and reboot them, in effect. So with relatively little downtime, we can do that. Now, we can also do that as what's called a stateful transfer, where because these CPUs are actually virtual, we know at any given point what the registries in those CPUs have got in them. And so if we know that we need to do physical repairs on a machine, or we get some error that says, I'm going to die soon from the machine, we can actually do a stateful transfer of those services across to the other machine. So what that means is it means no data's lost. Okay, there's a latency, it's about 10 seconds usually, as that machine migrates across. But basically it allows us to do things that we could never do with physical hardware. So, as I said, a little bit of the history and timeline. You can't kind of remove IBM, unfortunately, from this, but you can take a little step back. And there's a guy called Chris Strax who, in 1959, at an exhibition that I think was amusingly called the Tabulating Machinery Exhibition or something, but he did this paper on virtualization and talked about being able to virtualize these kind of machines. And it was those ideas that were taken forward and put initially in the IBM System 360. I've got a picture of a real one here. And then obviously the System 370 took those forward. I think this was the picture that Chris had this morning. In 1981, the IBM PC was launched, and by sort of the 90s, as Chris said this morning, we had these sort of cheap commodity servers, this kind of explosion, and we'll talk in a little bit more detail about the dot-com crash and how that all fitted together as we consider cloud computing in a few moments' time. By the time we got to 2000, we had this massive explosion, and it was about that time that the virtualization of x86 hardware, not the mainframe hardware, became a reality. So why would we bother virtualizing? Well, in the 1970s, the reason that they needed to virtualize was because the CPU speed that they actually kind of had available to them, if you compare it to today's CPU speeds, was relatively low. So and the problem was that the kind of the cost was incredibly high. So obviously what they needed to do was keep utilization as high as possible. So if this company was going to buy $1 million worth of machine, the last thing they wanted was for it to sit there doing nothing. They wanted it being used all the time. Okay, so a lot of the tools and things that IBM built at that time, things like queuing mechanisms, mechanisms for managing jobs, batch jobs, things like that, they were, all came out of this necessity from a pure economics point of view, that they were expensive. When we get to the sort of 1990s, the reason to virtualize is still there, but it's a different reason now. So the CPU speed is now huge, probably way more than we actually need. As John was saying earlier on, you know, we've got this real problem with bloatware now, where because we've got this huge excess of processing speed, people no longer have to write efficient code. You know, I remember working at BBC R&D and trying to write a piece of code that would process something within 1/25th of a second. And a lovely guy came along and showed me, I had like sort of 15 lines of code with if loops and all sorts. And he went, oh yeah, well, it's a bit of binary, blah, blah, blah. There you go. Two lines of code, and two instruction set. Yeah, we lost a lot of that with today's thing. So I have to agree with John there. So this massive CPU speed, actually, you know, it's a double-edged sword, and it's caused us as many problems as it solves. So we've got this huge problem with utilization now, because if you look at even your desktop PC, if you look at the amount of its CPU that it's using at any given time, it's tiny. You know, unless you're doing 3D rendering, or you know, you've just decided to you know, do a bit of standards conversion for some reason on your PC at home, it's really not going to be using much of its CPU. So the utilization is incredibly low, and the cost's low. So it's just dead easy to go and buy another server. The problem that then had was that the cost of electricity, the cost of cooling, and the cost of space just kind of rocketed. So you had these data centers where, you know, the IT guy was like, okay, well, I need a new email server. We probably could run it on this server here, but you know, we're gonna have all that hassle with DLLs and the wrong service pack and yada yada yada. Let's just go out and buy a new one. So that's what they did. They went out, bought a new one, shoved it in the rack, switched it on, powered it up, and away they went. And suddenly, you know, by the sort of turn of the century, you know, you had IT managers who were spending more on OPEX costs than they were on CAPEX costs in any given year. You know, spending more on cooling power than anything else. And suddenly whole companies were starting to look at their budgets and say, whoa, hang on a minute, we're spending vast sums of money here on power, cooling, and space, particularly if their data centers happen to be you know, in central London, where space was a real problem. So the real kind of imperative was to reduce the number of servers, increase the amount of compliance, and sort of really try and reduce that support burden that was going with all these multitude of platforms and so on. So can this kind of virtualization, a lot of the examples that I've given, I've kind of used IT examples, because to be honest, and I'm sure most of you are probably aware of this, but the IT industry, you know, they're not dabbling with virtualization anymore. They've accepted it 100% wholesale. The company that kind of kicked a lot of this off and really commercialized it and sort of did for Microsoft, did for virtualization what Microsoft did for sort of home operating systems, a company called VMware. If you look at what VMware's stock and the size of the company now is worth, it's incredible. I first started using that software when I was at university in 2000, and it was basically about four guys in California that were sort of, you know, writing a bit of code. It's now, you know, one of the biggest corporations. It's owned by EMC, and it's massive. So the IT industry, this is old news as far as they're concerned. The cloud's kind of new to them, but virtualization's been well accepted. But you know, can we use this in broadcasting? So just looking across the different sorts of areas that we find in a sort of traditional transmission focus sort of publisher broadcaster. If we look at applications like scheduling, rights, sales, the kind of back office functions, I mean, they're basically IT apps anyway. And in fact, I know of several broadcasters where, you know, we go in to do work and we find that actually they're already running this whole thing in a virtual environment anyway. And their IT department's just gone on with it. They've done it. They've made made no bones about it. So, you know, things like scheduling applications, traffic applications, writes, ad sales, all that kind of stuff fits this model perfectly. It tends to have fairly low CPU utilization, fairly low memory requirements, doesn't have huge amounts of storage needs. So it's an excellent candidate for virtualization and obviously by inference cloud computing as well. If we take something like, say, transcoding, totally different story. With transcoding, you know, we're interested in getting the absolute last ounce of power out of the CPU. So the last thing you want to be doing is sticking a virtualization engine in there. All right, you might only lose 4%, but hey, it's 4% that, you know, you're not going to need to spend money on an extra processor for. So, you know, things like transcode, you know, craft editing where you're doing a lot of rendering, totally inappropriate for this kind of technology. I will touch on craft editing a little bit later on because there are some really interesting things that are coming out, and I think the guys from Forbidden will probably touch on this as well, but there's work that's being done by Avid and Quantel where a lot of the processing is being done in the cloud, and then you're seeing a thin client representation. Avid was showing a kind of version of Media Composer, or looked like Media Composer, running in a web browser, running in Google Chrome at IBC this year. I don't know if anyone saw that, but certainly to come, I think, in the future. But today, you know, the transcoding type things, not the right kind of application. Something like a MAM system. There are certainly aspects of a MAM system where processing can be intensive, so things like file transfers and file movements and things, if your MAM system's getting involved in that, can certainly be intensive. But there are other aspects of it where it's basically just doing the same thing as an IT system. It's got a database, it's got some thin client applications that it's provisioning in many cases. So again, they can be good candidate systems. So we talked a little bit about virtualization, and when we talk about virtualization, we kind of by definition now can use it almost interchangeably with cloud. So where you have created an application that is capable of running inside a virtual machine, and you've created an image for that application, there's no reason why that has to be running internally to your business. Now, there might be good reasons why you want to do it, for security, for reasons of latency perhaps, but basically there's no theoretical reason why you can't run those on a cloud. So Chris talked about public, private, and hybrid clouds. I've given them slightly different names, but basically the same thing here, where we have this concept of an internal cloud. So an organization like, for example, someone like, say, Red Bee Media, who has a whole pile of clients that they service, might decide that they want to set up an internal cloud to provision out certain types of a facility that they want to sell to their clients. And it's just for their purposes. The reason it's interesting to them is it reduces their support burden. It makes them more agile so they can respond very quickly when someone wants a new channel or a new service. So that would be the internal cloud. But once you've kind of proven that concept works over a local area network, it's really not that difficult then to kind of imagine that, hey, well, you know, if we can just clone these machines, and it's probably worth just, I will touch on it later on, but a virtual machine is basically just a file, okay? So that virtual machine is an encapsulation of the hardware, the BIOS, the operating system, and all the applications and all the data and all the configuration that you've made, all wrapped up in a single file. It's usually a pretty big file, but it's just a single file. So you can put your virtual machine on a memory stick, walk over to another machine, plug it in, or walk down to another data center, plug it in, and just transfer that complete environment with all of the magic settings that you know, the MAM vendor had to put on for that particular scenario, or whatever. So, and it's abstracted from the hardware as well. So long as the virtual machine manager is doing its job properly, it presents a standardized virtual machine for the applications to sit on, and it doesn't care what the underlying the application doesn't care what the underlying hardware is. The virtual machine manager sorts that out. So it's a great advantage for application writers because they test once, they test for the virtual machine, and then they don't have to bother testing again. You know, VMware have to go out and test for every single hardware platform and make sure it's all compatible. So if we can just clone these machines, then there's no reason why we can't have a disaster recovery site which runs in the cloud. Likewise, we could have that as one resilient site, and then we could provision out a number of other resilient sites. We could run those on different continents. So for the test that I did over the summer, I used a particular data center provider who had sites in London, down at Docklands. So I sort of knew where my data was because it was in Docklands. I knew where the data center was as well. But they also had a data center in San Jose in California, and they had one in Barcelona, I believe, as well. And I could freely move my machines around if I wanted to. I didn't, but I could have done. And that leads you to the scenario where you can have a resilient set of sites provisioning these types of services, which are geographically much more resilient than the current model that we're often using, where we have a resilient site that's a couple of miles up the road or maybe the next town, but that doesn't protect you against geopolitical issues and so on. That's the external cloud, but then you might have this kind of hybrid cloud, this kind of public-private partnership, where you might have a number of different broadcasters or organizations who decide to provide one of these things, share the costs of providing it, and then provision out their resources within that. So obviously no examples of this in the broadcast environment at the moment, but plenty of examples in, say, local government. So the UK government, I believe, or I'm slightly out of touch because of where I choose to live at the moment, but I believe the UK government has provided a cloud infrastructure that local governments can then patch into and pick up machines from and use as an attempt to kind of reduce the costs. So if we want to actually move to the cloud, what's the problem that we're trying to solve here? Any broadcaster today who's producing sort of the standard linear TV channels is almost certainly going to be using a raft of sort of niche hardware and software. And in almost all cases, they either fully own that equipment themselves or they're fully outsourcing it. So someone like Red Bee is providing it as a service to them. And the problem with that approach is there's a real high premium on launching new services. And we all know today, rightly or wrongly, broadcasters like to launch new channels, new offerings, new interactive services. Oh, it's Wimbledon, we've got to have five new channels. You know, whatever the particular event is. And this kind of... This kind of issue mirrors the issue that the IT industry was having around the time of the dot-com crash. They had sort of spiraling costs and complexity of platform that was just causing them the most horrendous problems. And it was companies like Amazon that were facing these problems, where they just couldn't innovate anymore because the amount of infrastructure that they had, the amount of one server running one application kind of problems was just getting in the way of any kind of innovation that they were trying to do. And after the dot-com kind of bubble burst, Amazon took that opportunity to totally restructure the way they built their data centers. And they designed them around virtual infrastructure, automation, and the ability to provision resources at will. And it was so successful that they basically sort of marketed it as the Amazon Elastic Computing Cloud, or EC2 as it's generally referred to. So today you can go to Amazon and you can buy, you know, a Dyson vacuum cleaner, a couple of books from Jeffrey Archer, and you can buy a couple of servers. And the Amazon Elastic Computing Cloud will provision those, and you pay for them on an hourly basis as a utility. And it's not, I mean, I must admit, I thought it sounded fairly crazy when I when I first came across this. But actually, you know, this has been embraced by the IT community now. So an awful lot of companies now, if they want to launch a new development effort, they'll quite often just go to something like EC2. There are a number of others now as well, and actually buy those services rather than taking the time to set up individual servers, you know, find some space in their data center, et cetera, et cetera. The kind of term cloud, it probably, if you date it back as far as you can and you have a good sort of trawl around on the internet, I think the probably the first place was a paper that was written in 1996 by some guys from MIT. It's not actually mentioned in the paper itself, but the little diagram at the side there, there's this sort of squiggle in the middle which has the phrase in it, cloud of intermediate networks. And they were probably borrowing that term from the telecoms industry, who was starting to muck around with VPNs and so on and so forth. But the term cloud computing is a much more kind of recent phrase. It's widely credited that Eric Schmidt, from the CEO of Google, first used the term on the 9th of August 2006, so it's roughly 4 years old. Although rumour has it that Eric only mentioned that because he'd heard on the grapevine that Amazon were going to be announcing their EC2 on August the 24th, and apparently mentioned it as a bit of a spoiler, but you'll have to make your own decisions on that one. But yeah, just going back to what Chris was saying earlier on, in the early days, mainframes were kind of used, but the really key thing to what's made this possible, and the key thing where I think I probably slightly disagree with John, is that the thing that makes cloud computing different from anything that we've done before, and yes, there's a lot of similarities, but the main thing that's different is the standardization. So the first kind of wave of standardization that we saw was the, rightly or wrongly, the promotion of the IBM PC as the de facto standard, or more appropriately, the x86 series of Intel processors, and that instruction set that became the de facto standard for kind of commodity computing. Now, that didn't really get a kickstart until Linux and Windows NT came along, because prior to Linux and Windows NT, there was no real server tools around on the market to allow somebody to take one of these cheap servers and use it to do useful stuff like file serving or email and so on. So Linux and Windows NT provided that, and the cheap commodity hardware allowed companies to kind of restart some of the projects which they'd previously shelved. So there were a lot of companies where, you know, they'd say, well, we'd really love to open up a shopping website, but, you know, we're going to have to build another data center to do that. And there's all that expense. We're going to have all those DEC alpha servers and you know, all that DC power and all the rest of it. So it kind of put them off. But then when these cheap, cheerful servers came along, they suddenly thought, well, hang on a minute, you know, this is $1,000, we can buy 10 of these, shove them in a rack, and we can do that project that we wanted to do. So a lot of projects were sort of restarted, and there was access to new markets. As we said before, this kind of mentality of one server, one application deployment became a real sort of benchmark of the way that these kind of applications were deployed. It became commonly known as server sprawl, mainly because if you went into a data center, you just found thousands of servers, and most of them doing very little. It's incredibly high from a CapEx point of view, although these servers were pretty cheap, so no one really noticed. But the real cost was the OpEx. The cost of the power, the cost of the cooling and the floor space, kind of combined with the rising cost of energy in the Western world. And as IT budgets kind of increased, we started to get speculators jumping on the kind of dot-com and technology bandwagon. It got kind of called the dot-com bubble, but, you know, really a more accurate term for it would be a technology bubble, because this wasn't just about, you know, dot-com shopping channels. If you have a look at the NASDAQ composite, and if you take the time to have a look at what's actually in the NASDAQ composite, it's a wide spectrum of technology companies, not just dot-coms. And you can see the spike is quite prominent there in the run-up to the year 2000. And that was really fueled by this massive uptake of these x86, these cheap x86 processors. So the solution to server sprawl was virtualization. We've already talked about that. They had allowed total isolation for applications. They allowed multiple VMs to run on a single hardware, ironically rooted in sort of 60s and 70s technology. If you go back to some of the early computer scientists like John McCarthy in 1961, said, if computers of the sort I have advocated become the computers of the future, and they did, then computing may someday be organized as a public utility, just as the telephone system is a public utility. The computer utility could become the basis of a new and important industry. So, you know, back in 1961, John MacArthur was able to actually look and see that cloud computing is basically what he's talking about there would become a reality. Unfortunately, it took the biggest technology crash the world's ever seen to actually jumpstart that process that McCarthy had predicted. There's a number of key vendors that are making the technology today that makes cloud computing possible. Most of those vendors support a virtual machine model, a VM model. And originally it was all sort of every man for himself. They all had their own standards and so on. As I said before, a virtual machine is basically a single file. And it's an encapsulation of all the data that you need. So it makes it very portable. We've now got the open virtual format, which is a standard that's been adopted by VMware, HP, Citrix, I think, and a number of other key players. I think that will become the kind of standard going forward. And that means that you can take a virtual machine that you've created on one cloud over here, and you can pick it up and you can drop it onto somebody else's cloud. So it gives you agility, and it means you're not beholden to a single supplier. So, you know, one of the concerns that John raised earlier on is, you know, if this supplier is delivering this service to me, you know, how do I point the finger when it goes wrong? Well, usually you'd have an SLA, but you need to be careful, because if you look at the EC2 SLA, it's 99.97 uptime, which for a broadcast app is utterly useless. But fortunately, there are plenty of other providers out there that will give you a proper five nines or seven nines uptime SLA. They'll give you redundancy and various other things. So there are ways to solve that. Today, this technology is being used for email servers and so on. You can go to Amazon and you can order a server, and at the same time you can sort of click a box and say there's a company called Jumpbox that make pre-configured appliances, as they're generally called, which is basically an operating system with an application on it, which can then be deployed directly onto the EC2 cloud. So basically you can just go in and say, I want an email server, please, or I want a whatever. Press your buttons, pay your money, and away it goes. Obviously, you then need to go in and configure it, you know, for your precise needs. But a lot of that donkey work is taken out. We've all become familiar with the sort of software channel in a box solutions over the last couple of years, which, you know, largely are running on x86 hardware. There's no real reason why those applications, and I proved this over the summer with one particular vendor's products, where you can just run that application as a virtual appliance. So you can take a channel in a box solution, you can run it on a virtual machine. Now you're all sitting there thinking, well, how do we get baseband out the back end of that? Well, you don't, okay? You get a DVB transport stream over IP. Because why do you want to go back to baseband at that point? You know, if you're transmitting pictures, then your uplink site is not going to want SDI necessarily. So often a lot of ASI delivery these days is done as an IP, as a DVB compliant transport stream that's delivered over MPLS or an IP network. There's different ways that the technology is packaged. So Amazon EC2 provides kind of servers and databases. Third parties, as I said, like Jumpbox, provide the appliances that run on it. There are other services like Microsoft Azure, where you're buying kind of much higher level services. So you're buying like a Microsoft SQL Server, or you're buying a Microsoft kind of web development platform. So that's the way Azure works. And there are yet other models, and the cloud platform that I use, which is called Elastic Hosts, which is hosted in London, they actually provide you with quite a low level of machine. You can actually get into the BIOS and you can install your own application. So I install Windows XP on those machines because that's what I needed to do. You've got a lot of flexibility there. Going back to what Chris was saying before. It's quite helpful to think of it as a sort of layer model. So you've got the sort of physical servers at the kind of bottom layer. You've got the infrastructure, the kind of software that allows you to start and stop the virtual machines that are running on that hardware. And remember that a virtual machine is not beholden to a particular piece of hardware. So you fire it up one day and it might land on that machine. You fire it up another day, it'll land on a different machine. Obviously, you can tie those things down if you want to, but the whole point is that it's an agile solution. Then you've got the actual platform itself, and Chris kind of touched on what that was, but basically the platform allows you to bill based on CPU clicks or storage clicks or whatever it happens to be. just to give you some kind of indications of the costs involved, it costs about $30 to keep an x86 fairly well-specced server running for a whole month. And storage-wise, you're looking at about something like 2 pence per gigabyte per month or something like that. So again, it's relatively cheap. The solution that I built over the summer, I'm not using it at the moment, so I've closed all the servers down, but the storage is actually persisting, and I'm paying about something like $5 a month just to keep those machines there. So that's a really cheap disaster recovery site. If you're not actually running the things and you can fire it up relatively quickly, you can have very, very cheap disaster recovery in that kind of scenario. Or it could be disaster recovery of an already running cloud platform. So that's the platform. The infrastructure, applications, obviously, you know, the software that you're going to run on it. So we talked before about things like Google Docs and Salesforce.com. They're all appliances that sit on the top of that. And then the client is obviously the way that you interact with the actual machine. So usually it's through a browser, or it could be through something like VNC, type VNC, or remote desktop protocol or something like that. So the current cloud applications in broadcast, if we take a look, it's kind of prevalent across the whole workflow, but if you just look at some examples in ingest, it was once the preserve of sort of expensive hardware, but you know, today things like EVTR mean that you're not necessarily having to work with baseband. If you look at something like a PC with a capture card in it, you're not requiring sort of high-end machinery at the ingest stage. MAM, automation and traffic, there's a whole pile of vendors already that are offering software as a service models. Not many of them have been deployed, but many of them, when they deliver their kind of solution to you, you're basically working in a thin client approach with it. So the fact that you've got the servers in your own rack is kind of largely irrelevant. Transmission and uplink, as I said before, once you've come away from this hang-up of wanting to get SDI out the back of it, at the end of the day, the end goal is a DVB-compliant transport stream. So there's no reason why that has to be delivered over coax. It can be delivered over IP. And in fact, regardless of whether you like it or not, even if you give your telco supplier SDI, chances are it's going to go over MPLS or some form of IP on its way to your uplink site. This idea of a kind of stream-based workflow where instead of passing baseband around, we're actually passing around streams of compressed video is something which I think we'll see more of in the future. I think one of the, just kind of wrapping up here, I think one of the kind of primary areas where this kind of technology could get an early kind of kickstart, I don't think we're going to suddenly get the BBC knocking on TSL's door and saying, hey, we'd really like to transfer BBC One to a cloud-based playout solution, please. Lovely if it did, but actually it wouldn't. It would scare the pants off me. What I do think it has an application in early on is redundancy and disaster recovery. So imagine a scenario where we take a sniff of every file that lands on a transmission server, and we take a low-resolution proxy of that, and we dump it onto the cloud. And then we run a cloud-based playout solution, channel in a box, that picks up those low-resolution files, strings them together based on the same schedule that it's been sent from the automation system, and plays out a DVB-compliant transport stream at 2-3 megabits per second as a unicast, which is then picked up by the site that's doing your uplink. So they're getting their normal SDI feed. If that dies, they're also getting this unicast feed that's coming in. It's a DVB transport stream, so it's got all its timing data. Yes, there might be some latency there, but so long as it's consistent latency, we don't have huge issues there. The forward error correction and inherent rebuild ability of the transport stream will iron out a lot of the issues with the IP delivery, and indeed already does today. You contrast the cost of that with what some of the large broadcasters in this country have paid recently for disaster recovery sites. It's quite a marked difference. I think the kind of key thing to to enabling a lot of this is making sure that systems integrators like ourselves have really kind of got the right sort of skill set to move forward with this technology. So we're going to be using things like SOAP, XML, web services to integrate different bits of software together, rather than our kind of traditional role of integrating at GPI and RS-422 and SDI level. And the SIs that have sort of got the most experience in this are those that have been sort of working, you know, for the last 10 years delivering the sort of file-based workflows. They're going to be best placed to move forward with the kind of new stream-based kind of paradigm. So where are the gaps? Well, craft-based editing is something that's in a work in progress at the moment. As I said before, those of you that were at IBC this year, Avid showed a very interesting demo of Media Composer running in Google Chrome. But it's just a demo, but it's possible. Router source and destination style kind of abstraction. So an IP stream kind of knows where it's going, but a broadcaster generally works in a sort of, right, I've got a source and I'm going to route it to this destination. So there needs to be an abstraction there where someone provides a piece of middleware that basically sets up that IP routing based on a paradigm that the broadcaster understands. Procamp style tweaking of compressed streams is a really tricky thing to do. And if you're going to move into a stream-based workflow where people are delivering compressed streams to you and you are wanting to transmit compressed streams, then the idea of being able to get in and tweak part of that compressed stream, preferably without decoding, but probably not in the early days, is again something that's of real interest. So is this an opportunity or is it a threat? You know, most of the people in this room are probably broadcast manufacturers of some description or have links to and have a vested interest in the way that we do business today. If we actually look at the audio market and what happened in the audio market, I think it's a really interesting kind of thing to do. In the audio market, say, go back 5, 6, 7 years ago, you had manufacturers like Drawma, Focusrite, and they were making pieces of hardware that processed audio in a particular way. They liked what they did. They employed a lot of people with beards who, you know, had a great fun with pieces of, capacitors and resistors and all sorts. And they had a great business. Now, Pro Tools came along, Cubase VST came along, and provided a mechanism whereby you could provision all of that in software. But what actually happened was instead of Pro Tools stealing that market, they provided a plug-in architecture. So I think there's an opportunity here for us to provide that plug-in architecture. So we're all from different manufacturers. We all do different things well. And some of that's already started to happen. If you look at what Amberfin's done with Snell and Wilcox's kind of proprietary software knowledge, they've been able to market that successfully. So in conclusion, it is a polarizing technology. You know, for some, they think it's going to be a solution to all their problems. It probably isn't. You know, for some, it's a waste of time. You know, it's nothing different to what we've done in the past. I don't think it is. I think it does offer something different, particularly with the standardization. It's certain to have far-reaching implications, and already has in the IT industry, and I think in the broadcast industry. And the real kind of key to it is going to be having high-quality people that understand how to fit those different pieces together and understand the bigger picture. Thank you.